Morning. We're delighted to welcome you all to the first day of our calendar in November. And we are especially delighted to welcome students from Wayland Academy. Would they stand, please? Welcome. We've had students from the Academy a number of times, and we're glad to see you all. You may be seated, please. The students are here with a program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. And in this program, high school students from across the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. If they agree to come, they're given materials about the case, and they may engage in some activities centered on the case. They come, listen to oral argument, and then a justice is assigned to meet with the students right after our second case of the day. You will have a discussion with that justice on procedural matters, that is, how the court decides to take a case and how the court processes the case. There will be no discussion of the substantive issues involved in the case. And anyone who would like to join the students at noon is cordially invited to do so. If anyone here would like a copy of a summary of the case we are about to hear, just raise your hand and the marshal will provide one. Would anyone else like a summary? Good. While the we have some on this side too, Marshall. While the summaries are being distributed, let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. You will meet with Justice Prosser at noon. Seated to my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Brooks. To his left is Justice Patience Rogensack, and on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will call the first case, which is 09AP567CR. State versus Miguel E. Martinez, Jr. Arguing on behalf of the state is Rebecca Rapp St. John. And then we're going to hear from defense counsel, and then you get 5 minutes, Ms. St. John. You may proceed.
The circuit court allowed the state to play the victim's videotaped statement about the sexual assault in full without redacting her hand burning mentions after concluding that the hand burning mentions were integral to the victim's recounting.
I'd suggest that, one, you might get the microphone up closer to you so that we can hear better, and that there's this is a very hard room for acoustics. Cool. But, and then you may have to speak more slowly, but...
Okay, my apologies.
Let's see how this goes.
Okay. The circuit court allowed the state to play the victim's videotaped statement about the sexual assault in full without redacting the hand-burning mentions after concluding that the hand-burning mentions were integral to the victim's recounting of the sexual assault. The question that this court must decide is whether the circuit court properly exercised its discretion and reached a decision that a reasonable court could reach.
Counsel, I'd like you to spend a few minutes, if you will, to talk about the standard of review of the circuit court's discretionary decision in this matter and whether, in your estimation, the Court of Appeals engaged in a deferential standard of review to that discretionary decision or if it engaged in more of a de novo review. And if so, why is that important?
I believe that the Court of Appeals engaged in more of a de novo review. The Court of Appeals had sort of a confusing, in my estimation, standard of review paragraph. It talked about the established discretionary standard of review, said the independent review doctrine applied, and then had a curious last sentence that said, but we review whether evidence meets the statutory standard de novo, and then in my estimation applied a de novo standard of review.
Other than those two lines, did the Court of Appeals engage in any kind of express review of the Circuit Court's discretionary decision?
I believe the Court of Appeals looked at what it thought was a correct decision and applied an independently reviewed whether it would have admitted the evidence.
So the answer to my question is?
That the Court applied the incorrect standard of review, did not give discretion to the Circuit Court's decision, would be my answer. Now, why that's significant, you asked. It's significant in what you're looking at. Our argument's not that every single court would have to admit this evidence or not. The question is whether it was reasonable for the court to do it. Whether if you look at the record as a whole, the court could reasonably conclude that the hand-burning mentions were integral to this little girl's description of the sexual assault and account of the sexual assault in this videotaped statement. Now, the videotaped statement was admissible under 90808, which allows for the admission of these videotaped statements for kids, especially kids under the age of 12, if certain conditions are met. Allowing this hand-burning evidence in kept that videotaped statement, it allowed that to be played in full. You didn't have to splice it up. Now, the real heart of the Sullivan analysis, this court has said, in Payano and Sullivan, is the relevancy analysis. Like, why is it important to keep that videotaped statement in whole, apart from
can we just double back 1 minute?
Right.
Sorry. We're admitting this evidence under what provision? Well, the trial court admitted it under what?
808.
What does that say?
I cite it in my brief in chief on page 3, footnote 1, but it says that the circuit court shall admit a videotaped statement of a child under the age of 12 upon finding that the recording is accurate and free from excision, altercation, and visual or audio distortion, that the child's statement was made under oath or affirmation or some indication that the child knows the difference between truth and falsehood, that the time, content, and circumstances indicate that it's trustworthy, and that the admission of the statement will not unfairly surprise any party or deprive any party of a fair opportunity to meet the allegations made in the statement.
Any other provisions applicable?
To the admission of the statement?
Mm-hmm. Does it have to be relevant to something? It says accurate and free. I think everybody agrees on that. Under oath or some other system of showing that the child understood the importance of truth. That it's time, content, et cetera, that it's trustworthy, and that it won't surprise anyone. But doesn't it have to be relevant to something?
Right. I would agree that it would have to be relevant.
Yeah, to what?
To what? I think whatever issues in the case. I think you'd go to the relevancy statute.
Well, what about relevant in terms of other acts evidence? Does it have to satisfy other acts evidence?
I would argue statute? That it would. You can look at the statute and see the word shall admit and think that, well, you have to admit any of these statements, but I'm not making that argument.
No, I didn't think you were.
Right.
So does it have to satisfy 904042A?
Right. And
okay. And what does it have to do to satisfy 904042A?
I think that there's two things that it would have to do.
Okay, but let's go back to the standard of review. Under 904042A, there's a list. The general rule is it's not admissible. Other acts is not admissible, right? That's the general rule.
It's not admissible to prove propensity.
Right. Okay.
But right. I think that's different than saying the general rule that it's inadmissible.
That's right. I stand corrected, and I agree with you.
Okay.
So evidence of other crimes is not admissible to prove the character of a person in order to show that the person acted in conformity therewith. But it doesn't exclude evidence when offered for other purposes, such as, so it's not a total list, it's an example. Proof of motive, opportunity, intent, preparation, plan, knowledge, identity, or absence of mistake or accident, right?
Right.
So that's the legal standard. And whether the evidence fits that legal standard, do you think that's a question of law or fact?
Question of law or fact?
Yeah, or discretion.
I think it's a question of discretion.
Oh, you think it's a question of discretion as to whether any of the evidence fits any of those?
I'm just going by Hunt, whether evidence meets these standards, the different statutory standards, is considered a discretionary determination. And in Hunt, this court said that all three prongs of the Sullivan test, which includes that inquiry, is a discretionary determination.
Okay. Now, if we accept that, is it motive?
No, it's not.
Opportunity?
No.
Intent?
No.
Preparation?
No.
Plan?
No.
Knowledge?
No.
Identity?
No.
Or absence of mistake or accident?
No.
It doesn't fit into any of them. What does it fit into?
It doesn't have to fit into any of those.
Right. It says such as. I agree with you. It doesn't have to fit into any of them. What does it fit into?
I think it fits into two things, and I think...
Okay. What?
The first thing is it fits into the who, what, when, where of the crime. If you look at how the hand-burning mentions came up in this videotape statement, they came up, A, in terms of the timing of the sexual assault. The interviewer used it to try to pin down when the sexual assault occurred. And also the victim said specifically that she did not see the defendant again after he came to the hospital and apologized for burning her hands. So it fits with timing. Secondly, it fits with identity because it's how this little girl conceived of the victim or the perpetrator of the crime, the defendant of the crime.
I'm sorry, I thought you said it didn't fit under identity when I went through the list.
It's you're right, I did. It's a terminology thing. When you talk about identity in this context, they're generally talking about MO, or modus operandi, a handprint that somebody would always do when committing the crime. For example, somebody always wore a red glove when committing a robbery. So in the technical sense that it's generally used in the case law, it's not identity. But it was this little girl's way of conceiving of who the perpetrator was. So that's another thing. The other big thing is credibility. We know from the jury instruction that credibility is a very holistic determination. You're not just taking a few words that a witness says about a crime. You're trying to figure out who this witness is. In this case, it was trying to understand who this little girl was and how she kind of perceived the world and would convey information. And you start splicing up the videotape statement, particularly the little girl's statements about the who and when and where of the crime. You're impeding the jury's ability to assess credibility.
I assume that the who, when, where, when, and why of the crime is another way of saying what the court has said, that you can admit other acts evidence for context.
Yes.
So you really want to get this in as a context of a crime.
Right. But the focus of my argument... is supported by Hunt, but it's a bit different than you generally think of in the typical other acts case. In a usual other acts case, you're focused on the defendant, how the defendant's committed crimes in the past, the defendant's relationship with a particular victim. This case, my focus is on this little girl, the victim, and how she conveys information, and specifically how she conveyed information in the videotape statement. If the victim had not mentioned the hand burning in the videotape statement, I doubt the prosecutor would have sought to introduce the hand-burning evidence, and I certainly would not be here arguing that the hand-burning evidence should come in. My argument's contingent on the fact that it's the hand-burning mentions were part of how this little girl communicated about the sexual assault.
To what extent do you rely on a more liberal rule when sexual assault is crime, and especially for against a child?
The greater latitude rule?
Yes.
I think the greater latitude rule, according to the case law, it doesn't support automatic admission. It supports maybe a looser application of the law. How I'm really using it here is I believe that the rationales behind the greater latitude rule dovetail with my argument. This court has recognized that kids have difficulty conveying information. They communicate information differently than adults do, and that goes along with the psychological research I cited, too. And in my estimation, my argument's really about how kids convey information, and that's also why this court has recognized, or one of the reasons this court has recognized the greater latitude rule. So it supports recognition of the purpose of allowing the complete presentation of this little girl's videotaped statement.
So let me ask you, coming at this a little differently, one of the things that I understand the trial judge has to do, and obviously we have to look at it again here on appeal, is the applicability of 90403. In other words, the idea of probative value and unfair prejudice. How do you claim that plays out in this particular case? Because on the surface of it, to start telling a jury about how the defendant burned this little girl's hands appears to be something that really creates some prejudice. And so the question to me becomes, is it unfair given the probative value? How do you position yourself on that issue?
Well, the first thing I'd like to point out is the burden on this prong is on the defendant, Marinus, to show that the probative value was substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice and the other concerns in the statute. I think there's a couple things to consider. First off, the circuit court took a number of precautions to avoid unfair prejudice. Gave a limiting instruction during voir dire, after the defense counsel objected to one of the counsels that the questions that the prosecutor had asked. It gave a limiting instruction that it modified during the jury instructions, and the defendant specifically said that he approved of the instruction given. It also had limited the type of evidence that came in. There weren't huge details about this hand burning coming in, and it was really limited to what was in the videotaped statement. And that, again, shows why the real rationale for admitting this was the videotaped statement. And he had the prosecutor instruct witnesses to limit the details and had the prosecutor ask leading questions at one point to avoid extraneous details coming in. Additionally, I think the defendant emphasized that the hand burning and the sexual assault were different crimes, both in his questioning of witnesses and in his closing statement. And it's important to emphasize that the focus in this case was always on the victim, not on the defendant. In a normal case, you say the defendant did this, so the defendant's a bad person, and therefore the defendant committed this crime too. That's really what the other acts, case law, and statutes are concerned about. That was never the argument or the focus in this case. It was always on the victim, on how the victim conveyed information, whether or not the victim was credible. So that's another difference, say, in this case.
Well, go ahead. Counsel, I want to return to where you started here, and that is the standard of review.
Right.
And both justices, Justice Gableman and Chief Justice Abrahamson, asked you about that. In an erroneous exercise of discretion, standard of review, we have what I call boilerplate language that we use in all sorts of cases. And erroneous exercise of discretion has two elements that we use in a boilerplate. One is the court, circuit court, erroneously exercised its discretion if it misapplied the facts. The second is a circuit court erroneously exercised its discretion if it misapplied the law.
Right.
Do you agree with me that that's a paraphrase of consistently used language for standard of review, erroneous exercise of discretion?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, it's just stuff, as I say, we grew up with. So even though erroneous exercise of discretion sounds like, oh, this is discretionary, do whatever you want. You can't do whatever you want if you misapplied the law. And if you misapply, whether or not you misapplied the law, is a question of law. Would you agree with that?
I think when you look at cases like Hunt, they really explore what the erroneous exercise of discretion standard means in this context. And there they've always given circuit courts a lot of deference. They've really looked at whether or not circuit courts engaged in a rational, kind of looked at the standard, considered the facts, put them together, engaged in a process of reasoning and entering a decision.
I disagree with you on that. Because when I look at Hunt, I see Hunt saying the same thing that we always say. That is, erroneous exercise of discretion is, you got to look at they misapplied the facts, number one. Look at misapplied the law,
right,
number two. And Hunt took the Court of Appeals to task for not employing what we call the independent appellate review doctrine, looking at it ourselves. And, of course, they looked at then whether or not the court employed a rational basis. And as I recall Hunt, and so that language is in Hunt, just like I said, erroneous exercise of discretion is part of the standard of review. You'll look at to see whether or not the court misapplied the law or misapplied the fact. That's in paragraph 34 of the Hunt decision, and whether or not they applied a proper standard of law, used a demonstrated rational process, and reached a conclusion that a reasonable judge could reach. And so Hunt, as I read it, because the court didn't put forth, the circuit court didn't put forth its rationale fully, and because the Court of Appeals didn't employ the independent review doctrine to see if there was a misapplication of fact, law, and a rational basis, that the Hunt court did it, and then determined that each of the three prongs of Sullivan could be met.
Right.
So I don't know. You've got to point me to something to say that the Court of Appeals, as it did here, said it was admitted, in this case, I'm talking about our case, it was admitted for improper purpose. Boy, that seems to me, whether or not there's a proper purpose or an improper purpose is a question of law. Doesn't seem to me to be a question of fact. Can you point me to any place in Hunt or elsewhere that would say determining whether it's a proper purpose under the statute is a question of fact rather than a question of law?
I guess I'm working indirectly or backwards from Hunt. When you say the independent review doctrine applies to all three prongs of Hunt, or the independent review doctrine is going to apply, that's a discretionary standard of review. So you end up giving the Court of Appeals or the Circuit Court's ultimate decision more discretion than you otherwise would have given.
Oh, I think in the independent appellate review doctrine, we say, and let me use judiciously, I can say if the Court of Appeals blew it, but that doesn't sound very judicious. So let me say, if the Court of Appeals didn't do it correctly by scouring the record to see if the Circuit Court misapplied the facts, misapplied the law, and offered a rational, basis, then we do it.
Right.
But we still engage in the same examination. We see if the Circuit Court erroneously exercised its discretion by misapplying the facts or misapplying the law.
Right.
And I just think that whether or not meets a proper purpose under the statute 904.042 is a question of law. And you say it's a question of fact. And that was one of your basic premises. And I just need you to, if you can't now, later, cite me to a paragraph or something that would say that.
I thought it was a question of fact or a question
of... I think it's a question of law, but you're saying it's a question of fact, as I understand it.
No, I'm saying that circuit courts have discretion to determine why they're going to admit evidence for a reason other than the propensity inference.
But they don't have discretion to misapply the law, do they?
No, they don't have discretion in misapplying the law. I think that the Court of Appeals really focused, if it is a question of law, it took too rigid of a focus of what purposes you could admit for.
Yeah, that's exactly what I
distinguished
said.
Hunt inappropriately or on a kind of rigid basis where you can look at other purposes that are not in past cases or in the statute. It didn't apply the independent review doctrine. And then it took a bunch of stuff that's supposed to be in the relevance prong of Sullivan and put it in to the proper purpose prong, like whether or not there was a conviction and all sorts of things. So I think that, with all due respect to the Court of Appeals, their reasoning was a little jumbled for other reasons.
So let's talk a little bit. Were you done?
Yes, go ahead.
Let's talk a little bit about the Circuit Court's reasoning in this case. And there's an extract of the transcript at Petitioner's Appendix, page 177. Mm-hmm. And Judge Koshnick, starting at line 12, says, I think context in this case includes the date. And we have a young child. She is 5 years old, I believe. Sometimes it's difficult for young children to pin down a date that an event occurred, especially a difficult event like this. Then the next sentence, starting at line 16, the location, as far as which house they lived in, and whether it was in Jefferson County, significant, of course, because that would run to the issue of venue. when the crime was allegedly committed as part of the context. Line 19, the hand-burning incident also enhances the child's credibility because the hand-burning incident has now been established, I think beyond dispute, that the defendant has been convicted of perpetrating that act of abuse against the child. She complained of it and was examined at a hospital. Now, what did the Court of Appeals have to say that was critical of Judge Koshnick's reasoning there?
The Court of Appeals said that that was my argument, and then they said that there was no case law support for it. And I'd like to emphasize that that is not what I'm arguing, and I'd like to refer to that as the truthfulness rationale, the victim truthfulness rationale. And, the court
what about date and venue?
Well, the date and venue was my argument. The Court of Appeals distinguished Hunt, and this is when I'm getting back to Justice Bradley's, my exchange with her. I think the Court of Appeals rigidly focused on, well, that's not why it was admitted to go to the credibility of the victims in Hunt, so it's not a proper purpose here because it doesn't exactly match up with Hunt. Well, every case sort of, it's an organic thing. They evolve from the facts of the case, and you have to look at whether it's a proper purpose given those facts. So the fact that this doesn't match up with Hunt exactly, I don't think, is determinative.
Well, I believe your argument is that credibility comes in as part and parcel of context.
Credibility is related to the context and the girl's way of the little girl's way of conveying information about the sexual assault. But it's dependent on there being a reference to the hand burning in the videotape statement. The trial court in that one statement, I think it's mostly focused on the videotape statement, but in that one statement, it could support any admission of other acts evidence because it's true, therefore this is true. And that's not what I'm arguing. Did I answer your question?
Are you arguing because she was credible with regard to the hand burning, she's credible here? Is that what your argument
is? No, that's
is?
Exactly what I'm not arguing.
That's what I wanted to
right.
clarify.
So,
what are you arguing about credibility, precisely?
I'm arguing that to assess the credibility of a witness, you need to look at the witness as a whole, and it goes into her demeanor, all sorts of things that you'll get if you watch the videotape statement that you don't get from the text that's just put in the defendant's brief.
So if you had spliced the video and got her demeanor, that wouldn't have been enough?
No, I'm arguing that it...
I mean, you're arguing it's demeanor. Demeanor doesn't require every single line she said, does it?
There's a couple points about the slicing. He argues, well, you can just slice up the videotape. I mean, I think credibility is contingent. The witnesses, the victim's testimony is being applied almost entirely or played almost entirely before the jury with this videotape statement pursuant to a statute that allows its admission. In order for the jury to assess her credibility, they need to see as much of her as possible, particularly her statements about the who and the when of the sexual assault. Playing the videotape statement in whole allowed them to see that. When you talk about slicing, it doesn't account for the breadth of the credibility analysis. It doesn't account for the difference between a videotape statement and text. And also, it doesn't account for the case law. We have from Veach and Davidson and Plessmeyer, the state does not have to stipulate to certain facts just because it can to not introduce other acts evidence. And the fact that there's alternative methods of proof does not affect the other acts analysis. And in fact, that's what he's arguing.
Your red light's on. You're going to have 5 more minutes. Counsel, you might look at Hunt on paragraphs 54 through 61 for the standard of review and the court applying anew how the evidence fits within the permitted purposes of 90404. Counsel?
Thank you. The
court. Your name is pronounced?
My name
Slagelsky.
Is Ralph Slagelsky.
Got it.
And I'm thrilled to be here on this election day, and I do approve of this message.
And everybody. Everybody who is eligible to vote will vote.
Now we'll see if we approve of your message.
Find that out in a couple of months, I assume. The Court of Appeals stated that it would be difficult to conceive of a juror who would not be inclined to believe that a man who would burn the hands of a child is the same sort of man who would sexually abuse a child. I would submit that what Attorney Wambaugh did, he's here today, by the way, was tried to get in this evidence to simply turn the emotion of the case against Mr. Marinez. It was of incredibly slight relevance. It basically maybe came in for timing purposes, which I think kind of goes in with the context issue. But obviously it is not one of those 904.042 precise reasons for putting it in the first place. And as Justice Crooks has already mentioned, 904.03, I believe, was where this case ultimately fails. That's the portion of the statute. That's a portion of the rules of evidence that I believe really came into play when I first sat down in my office up in Manitowoc and started looking this over, that 904.03.
Counsel,
yes.
Do you agree with opposing counsel that it's your burden to show that it's unfairly prejudicial?
I believe that's what the case law has
provided. Okay, and so it's not just that it might hurt your case, but something about it has to be unfair in the way in which it hurts your case, correct?
Correct, unfairly prejudicial.
Okay. And what is the burden by which you have to meet that test?
Boy, you asked me a tough question right off the bat. I don't exactly recall what it is, but I believe that it is a burden of proof of some kind. It's obviously not beyond a reasonable doubt. But I believe that it had to be shown that it was indeed unduly and unfairly prejudicial. I don't have the exact language at the tip of my brain. I'm sorry.
Counsel, you emphasize in your opening few sentences Mr. Wambach's alleged misuse or misemphasizing of the hand-burning incident. And, in fact, you echo that in the brief that you've submitted at page 20. You say, the most telling portion of Mr. Wambach's closing argument described Marinez's criminal character as someone who would injure a child so severely that she required treatment in two separate hospitals. That's your brief, I believe.
Correct, page 20, yes.
And then you go on to extract a portion of Mr. Wambach's closing argument, and you quote that section that states, well, what would you expect? I mean, she had serious burns, and she was in two different hospitals. And then you provide a cite, and then you ask rhetorically, how can this possibly be within the law's limitations for narrowly tailored other acts evidence? But if I turn to the full transcript of Mr. Wambach's closing arguments, which are at your appendix, page 124, line 17, it starts out, Mr. Wambach's comments start out, let's turn to what the defense argues. Look at how different the child acted between talking about the burning of her hands and her private area being violated. Now, that part wasn't in the part that you quoted in your brief, right?
No, it was not.
And then it goes immediately into the part that you did quote. And then he finishes up with another part that you did not quote. That, of course, is going to have a much greater impact on you when you are four and when you don't even necessarily have an appreciation for just how private that private area is. Now, what would your response be if I told you it looked to me as if Mr. Wambach was responding to a defense argument rather than on his own trying to emphasize some piece of evidence?
Well, I do believe that it came out in his rebuttal closing, if I'm not mistaken, that particular portion.
An apparently direct response to a defense argument.
Right, but I do not believe that, well, what would you expect kind of language. I believe that.
Say that again, you do not what?
I do not believe it would be that, well, what would you expect? I believe that other acts of evidence should not become what the trial is about. I don't think anybody disagrees with that. But I think that what is mentioned is that, 24 separate times, this other acts of evidence was provided to the jury. Including, especially, I think, in the Mr. Wambach's closing rebuttal argument. It is talking about two separate hospitals, which, by the way, never appeared in the videotape. That came out of the mother's testimony. Rachel Marinez testified about the two separate hospitals. The child never mentions that in the videotape. I believe that when the whole videotape issue came up with Judge Koshnick, that, okay, the videotape's going in, and you know what? Because of 904.03, I'm very concerned about that. We'll put that limiting instruction in. We'll even tailor it to make sure that we're dealing with this specific case. And number two, I've got some limitations here. Well, the limitations, I believe, in this trial were ignored. Now, I don't know how that is dealt with on appellate review, but those limitations that...
were the limitations that were ignored?
The limitations regarding the number... basically staying within the confines of the information within the videotape that the child provided. But then, Rachel Marinez, the defendant's wife, testifies, and beginning a bunch of other things. The two hospital issue was, I think, one of the primary ones. The jury had already heard from the child And yet, the next witness called, I believe, was Rachel Marinez. And Rachel Marinez goes into even further detail about the hand-wringing, which, by the way, I would defy anybody to look at the Rachel Marinez direct testimony and find anything regarding the sex assault. It's all about the hand-wringing and some other context issues. Where did you live, venue, timing? Yes?
Well, you're, seems to me, focusing your argument, and maybe it's because the court has moved you there, to the issue that Justice Crooks wrote, raised, namely that whether it was law, an error of law or an error of reasoning in letting it in, you don't even have to deal with that because is it unfairly prejudicial? And my understanding is that you are arguing, or your brief argues, it's unfairly prejudicial because its relevance is slight, if any.
Correct.
But it's a prejudicial effect, which means that the jury is hearing something that incites its passion rather than reason. I mean, that's one definition of prejudicial. And that what the jury has heard was that the defendant intentionally burned a child. Intentionally burned a child's hands so that the child went to the hospital. Stayed overnight, or stayed a while anyway. And that, what do you think of a person who intentionally burns a little child's hands? Not much. And that's the prejudicial thing, that if you burn a child's hands, you're going to do something else that's bad to a child, right?
That's the natural conclusion, yes.
It is a bad man, right?
That's
why you think it's prejudicial.
Correct.
Unfairly prejudicial. Not that it damages your case, but that it damages it unfairly because it does exactly what 404B says you shouldn't do, namely keep from the jury that you're prone, the man is prone to criminal activities.
Prone or propensity, correct, yes.
Well, okay.
Well, propensity to be bad.
Propensity to be bad.
Or to harm a child, yes.
I don't want to move you too far away from that, so I want you to continue your argument, but I want to go back to the issue of whether this evidence should have been admitted at all.
Well, yes, and I submit it should not have. We do have, of course, the Hunt case, and I'm going to disclose something here. I agree with Justice Crook's opinion in the Hunt case, the overall resolution. I also have tremendous respect for Justice Bradley's dissent.
And rightly so, since I joined it.
Gives it greater weight.
Both ways, Justice Crooks. I don't know. We'll see.
Filling up to Justice Crooks, we do both come from...
Sucking up. Go ahead.
But in that particular case, the Hunt case, you had retaliation by the victims. The victims came forward to the police station, said, this man's doing these awful things. And then, of course, a little while later, say, oh, no, we just made it up. We were mad, whatever. And I think that the state in that particular case had some sympathy because they had to somehow explain the recantation. And I think that there was, therefore, a very valid reason under the Sullivan test, prong one and two, to bring that in. I don't think there's anything nearly as integral or imperative in the case to do that here.
Mr. Sikalski, what was the defense put on by the defendant in this case?
Simply that it did not happen, I believe.
This didn't happen.
Right.
So that the little girl was not telling the truth, is that right?
Correct. That was, yeah. Don't believe what she has said beyond a reasonable doubt.
And how was that defense presented?
It was presented, I believe, mostly on cross-examination. Attorney De La Rosa's closing, I believe, was only about 10 pages long, dealt a great deal with how little evidence there really was, and that's even with the entirety of the videotape in there. I think he tried to limit the use of the hand evidence a bit. I think he was trying to keep his focus away from that, obviously. But it went into, we don't have enough detail here, that type of thing.
Okay, so how old was the child
I believe she was 4 or 5 at the time.
And when was the video statement made?
Sometime afterward. She had been in the hospital, I believe, till about December 27th was the last time that the defendant and the victim had contact. And I don't recall exactly when the videotape was made, but I believe it was some months later. I may be wrong on that.
The complaint alleged that sexual assault occurred really before. It doesn't allude to the burning hands, but it had to have been before that. Isn't that right?
Right, because the burning hands result in the child going to the hospital, and Mr. Marinez was never alone with the child after that point. I believe they narrowed it down to about 3 months' time frame.
So the video, did the video testimony establish when the event occurred?
Not very well. I read through that again several times, and I believe the child was very vague on that. Did this occur before or after her hands? I don't know, is essentially what the child said. There's a little bit more language to that effect, but it wasn't at the same time. But she could not tell whether it was before or after.
But did she say that the defendant visited her at the hospital?
I believe so. December 27th of that year, I believe, is when that visit would have occurred.
And did she say that she ever saw the defendant after that?
Correct. And I believe that Rachel Marinez testified to the same thing. The child also testified that Mr. Marinez apologized, I think, at that December 27th time. That was very clear in the child's mind.
So... didn't the testimony really establish that the sexual assault, if it occurred before December 27th?
Correct. But that also came out through the mother. I think far more clearly it came out through the mother.
That came up afterwards, didn't it?
Excuse me, within the trial?
After the tape had been played.
After the tape was played in the trial, then the mother testified thereafter and provided very precise adult detail, if you will, about when the contact had ceased between the two of them.
The essence of this case was that the state charged a sexual assault of a 4-year-old girl, and the defendant said it didn't happen, that she wasn't telling the truth.
Correct.
Counsel, was there a stipulation? I know that the defense attempted to stipulate a couple of things, but help me with this. I believe that, one, there was a stipulation with the state that after December 27th, there was no further contact with the child and the defendant. Was that a stipulation that was entered into?
I believe it was. I know there were other stipulations that the state did not agree to.
That's right, but I think that was. Is that your understanding, or am I wrong?
I don't believe you're wrong.
Okay.
I'm not 100% sure of that, but I believe that's
okay. Accurate. So, assuming I'm correct, and that may be a dangerous assumption, but assuming I'm correct that there was a stipulation that there was no contact after that date in the hospital. In fact, I think the court referred to that stipulation, the circuit court. What, if any, value is the videotape on the issue of timing?
I believe there was virtually no value because the child's answer to the question to the social worker, I believe, was could have been before, could have been after, she wasn't really sure. And she certainly didn't narrow it down saying, you know, it must have been within 90 days before he last saw me. There's nothing to that effect in the videotape. I think the timing is incredibly slight in that videotape.
I have on page 205 of the petitioner's appendix, it says, did the touching on your private area happen before your hands were hurt or after your hands were hurt or both? And answer, I think it was a different time. It was a different time, yeah. What happened first, the touching on your private area or getting your hands hurt? Answer, I don't know which one was first or last. I don't know. Question, you don't know. Okay, et cetera. Then it goes on to talk about the microphone. So when I read that, I didn't know that it really offered that video excerpt on timing offered much. Where else is there reference in the video, if at all, on the issue of timing?
I don't think there really is any other than December 27th was the last time I saw him, but I don't think she even has, of course, the date. She's a child. But the last time I saw him was at the hospital, and he apologized for burning my hands. And then that was tied up with Rachel Marin's testimony about December 27th being the last day. But I obviously bringing in a lot of excess baggage on burning hands was not necessary.
Did the defendant object to venue?
No. I believe that venue was established even as early as the preliminary hearing stage.
But you didn't object.
I don't believe there was an objection there. I think that there was a little bit of an argument at the end of the prelim where he said, well, lower standard for preliminary hearing testimony. We have these issues out there, Jefferson County. I believe he stipulated the jurisdiction at first, but then later on he might have actually stipulated venue. I'm not sure.
He did. So this doesn't establish venue.
No, and again, Rachel Marin has provided that clearly.
All right. What else did the state say it established that you don't think it does?
Well, I think that whole
time,
idea of context.
Place. Pardon me?
I believe context in light of...
Well, wasn't context... well, included in context was time and place. Okay. What
right.
else was included in context?
Well, I believe they wanted to get to the fact that Mr. Marinez lived with this child, that, you know, the child's mother was married to Mr. Marinez. I think that perhaps some issues that he was potentially alone with her. I don't really see it coming out in the videotape, though. Again, that comes out in Rachel Marinez's testimony.
Well, let's look at what the circuit court said was in context. As I recall, the circuit court said identity and context. And context, included in context, was time, was location, was corroboration, hyphen, credibility, and telling the full story. Those are the things that
right.
the circuit court said was included context. So we've addressed time, we've addressed location. Address credibility, if you would.
Well, I think credibility, first of all, is the judge, as I recall, was very concerned about credibility. Let's just put it that way. One witness commenting on the truthfulness of another witness is strictly not allowed. There are, of course, a few exceptions to that.
Let me focus your response, because I don't think we have one commenting on the credibility of another. Your opposing counsel says they are not arguing, the state is not arguing, that because the child told the truth in the hand burning, that she's telling the truth in this case.
Right.
So within that statement, tell me how this information does or does not, this information being the video and the video transcript, goes to credibility.
Well, I believe Judge Koshnick did say that while she's credible about that, it's been established that he burnt her hands, and I think this assists with the credibility determination. I believe he does say that in his decision.
What's the usual way of showing credibility, approving credibility of a witness?
Demeanor, providing objective criteria. Was it the day after Christmas? Was it the day of your birthday? That type of thing. You just provide objective, and of course, in the trial court, demeanor.
But if you're going to bring in somebody else, you have to do it in what way?
Well, I believe it has to be questioned first. Right.
Okay.
Reputation, truthfulness, honesty, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And so you would question a child that way in terms of...
Well, you do the greater latitude rule, as in the Davidson case talks about, but I do not believe that credibility is this carte blanche allowed for a child making these types of accusations. I believe you put the child down there. Does she appear credible, whether it's in the videotape or personally? And, I'm mostly a trial lawyer. I've only got 7 people to deal with here. Usually I've got 12, okay? And what I found, they don't ask as many questions, of course, but...
Okay.
What I find is that when I've tried these cases in various courts in the northeastern part of the state, and if the victim gets up there and is credible and is believable and doesn't fold under cross-examination, that's it. Defense loses. And in this particular case, the child was put up for literally just a few questions about background, where she went to school, that type of thing, to satisfy the 908.08 provision to allow in the videotape. And the jury could or could not believe her, I think would be more candid discussion with Ms. Orne, the social worker, on the videotape in a more comfortable setting with, you know, toys and that type of thing. So I think that credibility, it was there before the jury. Why was anything else needed, especially in light of 904.03? Yes, sir.
At trial, the victim, alleged victim testified.
Sorry, excuse me.
The alleged victim testified at trial.
Yes, she did, very briefly.
And was there an effort to attack her credibility?
There was none whatsoever, because the Mr. De La Rosa had no questions for her.
Okay.
Let me ask this.
You have appeared before the court a number of times.
It's about there.
Here. Mm-hmm. And I've always been very impressed with your arguments. And I mean that sincerely.
I'm impressed with your opinions. So.
Enough already.
That's all you need for.
All right. If you had been in Mr. Wambach's position, how would you have kind of firmed up the credibility of this child?
You obviously would have asked her. I do not know whether or not she was in the courtroom when the videotape was being played or not. If she was not in the courtroom, which I think is the usual practice, you would say, I won't mention her name, but young child, do you recall speaking to Ms. Orne over here, the social worker, at some point? Yes. Do you recall it was, you know, a blue room with a play set in it and, you know, whatever? Yes. Do you remember when you did that? Yes. Now, you talked to Ms. Orne about many things, didn't you? Yes, we did. Were you telling the truth that day? I believe I was. You know, however the child will answer. That's how you would firm up, if you will, her testimony from the videotape.
Her understanding of what's true and not true.
Well, of course.
That's pretty vanilla.
If I had her here, believe me, it would be a little bit more detailed. But, you know, that's how I didn't consider what Mr. Wamba's role was in this situation. Mostly do defense work. But that's how I believe that I've seen prosecutors do that sort of thing. So, okay. As I mentioned, I believe it was 24 occasions that this hand-burning evidence came into the court, came into be heard by the jury. If you include especially that they wanted to see the videotape in their conference room to discuss what was going to be happening. If you look at the rest of the evidence in this case, Ms. Marinas testifies not one bit about the sexual assault. Detective Brower does not mention anything regarding it. When the child is cross-examined, nothing's mentioned about anything, whether it's burnt hands or whatever. The real guts of this case, the real concrete detail that these jurors are left with as they're walking out of the courtroom into the jury deliberation room, is a child with bandaged hands being moved, I think, from the local hospital to the university hospital. And I think, with all due respect, the other act's evidence went way too far in that respect in this particular case. I got to admit, I was a little surprised when the Court of Appeals came down and said that the first Sullivan prong was where this case failed. Surprised may be a strong word. I was pleased, obviously. But I thought if this case failed anywhere, it was going to be under the 904.03 analysis, because this was just incredibly unfairly prejudicial. And what I've done, Justice Bradley, you're about, no?
Are you finished? I have a question if you are, but if you're not, okay. Keep on rolling.
Okay. I've gone through every single case cited in both the briefs, in the reply brief, in the Court of Appeals, and what I've seen is that, for example, in the Davidson case, we have what is called, quote, striking similarities between the other act and the alleged crime that was in there. In the Fishnick case from 1985, dealing with sex with a 3-year-old and a prior 13-year-old conviction, it was other acts were allowed in for motive and identity. And that quote from the trial judge, and it was in the appellate court, actually this court's decision 25 years ago, was, quote, a concurrence of common features, unquote. Go on to the Friedrich case. It talks about a plan being virtually identical. And that was, again, sex with a 14-year-old babysitter. What you have throughout these cases, when you are dealing with especially child acts, are essentially the same. There's a motive. There's a plan. There's something that you can say this marks the imprint of something that should be allowed in under other acts. Now, I got to admit, too, when I was researching this, I didn't realize other acts went back more than a century. The Proper versus State, or State versus Proper from, I believe, was 1893. I thought it was something relatively new. But when I go through these cases, and I've immersed myself in them, I see that when you're dealing with children, you don't bring in something completely separate. If this case is not, well, if the Court of Appeals decision is not affirmed, I think this will be a giant leap for the case law in Wisconsin in this regard, that we are basically going beyond what has been done before and say, you cannot just bring in other sexual acts. Yes?
Well, this case, I think, and when I listen to the state, relies heavily on context. And I think there are cases where context is important to tell the whole story so you get a true picture of what is happening relating to that particular crime. And the court has accepted the concept of context. But it seems to me that context can be so broad as to include everything. And so I went to cases looking at context. And in 2009, the Seventh Circuit said that if you use context and you use it too broadly, it just swallows up the whole rule about limited use. And they're not the only ones. This concept, the context is important, but should be cabined, goes back to 2000 in the District of Columbia Circuit and another Seventh Circuit in 2008 and other cases like that. And they say you have to really look to see if there's any relevance at all here. That's why I've been questioning you about time and place, et cetera. And I think that's why you go to the last part of unfair prejudice.
Right. That's what I saw this case being about. The Court of Appeals beat me to that particular punch. I think that the McGowan case as well doesn't really necessarily deal with context, but that's from 2006. It's in the Court of Appeals case that basically says that when the defendant committed another sex crime or actually was an adjudication or just a juvenile act, that was when he was a child and the victim was a child. Now he's an adult. We just don't have the nexus. We don't have the linkage here. And that's, I believe, important. Now, McGowan stands for the proposition, as the Court of Appeals essentially found, that you have to have some relevance before you allow in all this stuff. And even regardless of even getting to 90403, it just doesn't resonate. It doesn't sit well. So,
The alleged sexual assault occurred before the end of December 2006.
Correct.
But the tape, as I understand it, wasn't made until June of 2007.
Thank you. Yeah, 6 months later then. That's okay.
Did the little girl tell her mother about the sexual assault?
I don't recall how it came out very well. I look at transcripts, and I have to dig to the heart of the transcripts. I'm not sure how the accusation really came out.
But
I don't think it came out of trial.
A substantial period of time went by before the alleged sexual assault came out. Isn't that right?
6 months is a long time, but as a trial lawyer, I've seen cases that came out 10, 20 years later. So the statute of limitations is quite lengthy. So.
Was any use made of the fact that it didn't come out for quite a while?
I believe that Attorney De La Rosa might have had that as one of his arguments. I don't believe it was the core of his arguments. I think it may have come out of trial. I can't point to a specific spot. I mean, he was trying to cast doubt however he could. I think he pointed out that.
What else did he do to try to undermine the credibility of the child?
Well, again, the cross-examination, especially of the mother, Rachel, and then his closing argument was really, well, we don't have enough detail here, that type of thing, as I recall. I mean, yes?
He argued, and it seemed as though both attorneys agreed, that there was about 2 minutes with regard to the testimony in the videotape about the touching. Without the evidence about the hand burning, do you think there would have been enough in the record for the jury to return a verdict of guilty?
I believe so, and red light's on. I'll just answer that if I may.
Yes, you may, Counsel.
The last few pages of my brief basically took a great deal of time to point out how that the core of the videotape testimony regarding the touching could have been presented without any compromise as to what the child's credibility or any other potential issue was. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Ms. St. John?
Context was a huge issue in this case. It was the case. The case really consisted of the videotape statement of this young 4-year-old girl being played before the jury. It's great for us to stand in the position now of knowing that Marinez was convicted, but the prosecutor, when he was trying this case, did not know that. He knew he had this videotape, and he knew what the defense was because it was also made at the preliminary hearing. It was that it was too vague for a conviction. The girl was too vague for a conviction. She delayed her disclosure. It was that she was confused about good touch and bad touch, that she was getting a bath. Those were his defenses. So the prosecutor is in the position of trying to convince a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that this little girl was sexually assaulted based on what Marinez characterized as pretty much 2 minutes in a videotape statement about the sexual assault, as well as using the videotape to try to shore up for the jury why this little girl was credible and why her account of the sexual assault was true.
Counsel, it sounds as though you are saying that this evidence regarding the hand burning is highly prejudicial. Is that correct?
I believe it was prejudicial. The highly prejudicial, I think there were a lot of things that mitigated against it being highly prejudicial. It is
closing argument in rebuttal, the attorney for the state said, in essence, without the context testimony, I can guarantee you the verdict would be not guilty. Do you agree with that?
I think if you just played the 2 minutes of videotape in which this little girl was saying that she was sexually assaulted, it would be hard to get a conviction. And that's because the credibility inquiry is so broad. And that's what the state's arguing.
But we're not just talking about playing the 2 minutes. We're talking about the question is whether or not, is not whether you should keep in the 2 minutes. The question is whether you should take out the reference to hand burning and leave in all of the other stuff in addition to the 2 minutes regarding the sexual assault. But my question to you was, did you agree with that statement that I would submit to you that without other context, without a backdrop and a framework you jurors had, all you had was the state playing those 2 minutes and nothing else. I can guarantee you that the verdict would be not guilty because you would have nothing in order to assess the state's witnesses.
I think you have to take the prosecutor's statements in context of his entire closing statement. I mean, he was referencing the pepperoni factory that the girl talked about that her mom worked at, everything. He's trying to get the jurors in the head of this little girl to have them understand why her statements may be vague and not as complete as an adult and to understand that she is a reliable source of information. So it's not just about, if you didn't know about the hand burning, you wouldn't convict this girl. It's that if you didn't have a context for understanding this girl and how she conveys information, you would not convict him. That's what it was.
When you talk about the context, was there simply 2 minutes and that would have been the total amount of her testimony if everything about the hand burning had been taken out of the video?
No, there would be, that was the defense argument that there were only 2 minutes about the sexual assault. There would be other stuff in the videotape but the hand burning.
Get to see her.
Pardon, they did get to see her.
So they could get to see her, but was that you, Justice Bronson?
Some of the other questions and answers on the tape showed the child's confusion.
And I think that actually helps for her credibility. The one response is, well, she didn't know the timing, so that didn't go help with timing. But it did because the prosecution was trying not only to shore down the time, it was also trying to show the jury who this little girl was and how she conveyed information. And in a way, I think it helped rebut the vagueness defense to show her ability to convey information. Most of us would know which happened first. An adult would. A 4-year-old girl may not.
What, if anything, about her responses in that videotape went to timing?
A couple things. One, the interviewer used the sexual assault to try to pin down when the timing occurred. The little girl could not say which happened first, but as I was saying, I think that that's important for the jury to know. Secondly, the little girl did say that she did not see the defendant again after he came to the hospital, and that definitively shored down the time. There's a lot of talk about misuse of the testimony.
Was there a stipulation by the state as to that issue? Was I correct in that the state stipulated?
And the state offered to make that stipulation, and they agreed.
That is, there was no contact after the hospital.
Right. The defendant also asked about a stipulation about the exact dates, and the state refused that because it wanted this hamburger to come in because it wanted to play the videotape in full. There's a lot of talk about misuse of the the hand-burning evidence. A couple of things to say. First, that's a different issue than the state petition for review on. The state petition for review on whether this videotape should have been admitted in full. The Court of Appeals did not decide any prosecutorial misuse issue. The state didn't raise it in a petition for review, and Marinus didn't raise it in a cross petition. Further, just logically speaking, I'm sorry, my time's up.
No, you can finish your statement.
Okay, the idea that unobjected to errors at trial can parlay into a violation or an erroneous exercise of discretion in entering an other acts order or any order in the first instance logically doesn't make sense and then violates the contemporaneous objection rule. And finally, if these really are errors and exceeding the order, that almost underscores the limits of the order and that the order wasn't as expansive as Marinus is now trying to claim.
Counsel, I just would like to talk to you about the issue. The issue that you set forth, and I've got the right brief, is did the circuit court erroneously exercise its discretion by admitting a videotape without exception of the hand-burning references?
Yes.
That issue would include all three prongs of the Sullivan test.
Yes.
Okay, so I didn't want to misunderstand you that you were, I heard you as trying to limit this issue to just the first prong. That is not the issue before
the court. No, in fact, I think the core of the analysis really hinges on the relevancy, or the second and third prongs. The first prong in Payano is just setting up the second prong.
And the third prong of unfair prejudice.
Right, exactly.
That those are all in this case.
Right.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for yet another interesting argument relating to other acts evidence. The court has had many cases involving this issue. And as defense counsel pointed out, the issue goes far back in the history of the court and in evidence. And so we end 09AP567CR, State versus Miguel E. Martinez, Jr. Thank you. The court will take a brief recess because these students may wish to leave and additional students will be coming in. We are in recess.